You're listening to TIP.
In today's classic episode that originally aired back in September 2018, Preston and I were absolutely privileged to interview Tony Robbins. Preston and I have followed Tony for years, so having a chance to sit down with him and share our discussions with you was unforgettable. During our discussion, we talked to Tony about his books Unshakable and Money Master the Game. Additionally, we talked to Tony about the things that matter the most, which is how a person can find their higher purpose, how to accomplish the things people want to master in their own lives, and most importantly, how to have a real impact. For people who are not familiar with Tony, he's a New York Times bestselling author of multiple books. He's also an entrepreneur of multiple businesses that produce $6 billion annually. So without further ado, here's our interview with Mr. Tony Robbins.
You are listening to The Investors Podcast, where we study the financial markets and read the books that influence self-made billionaires the most. We keep you informed and prepared for the unexpected.
We are super pumped to be here with the one and only Tony Robbins, number one New York Times bestseller across multiple books. Stig and I, we're a little bit shell-shocked right now, but Tony, welcome to the Investors Podcast. We are thrilled to have you here.
Gosh, I'm thrilled to meet you both. I know you guys have the number one podcast of its nature in the world, so I feel honored to be here, and thank you for your kind words.
Yeah, thanks, Tony. So we're just going to jump right into this first question. So Stig and I have read your book, Unshakable. We've also read your book, Money Master the Game. You talk about this in the book, but I want you to explain it to our audience. What was your motivation to get out there and write this? I mean, your first book was a behemoth, and your second one's your second one's big. So what inspired you to do this? Because this is not an easy undertaking to do this.
I love, you know, things that are where there's no net. I love the idea of a live event because you never know what's going to happen. You got 10 or 25,000 people, and you know, you never know what's going to happen. And I love that playing with Onet and the newness of it all. You know, writing a book, you're sitting solitary. There's no feedback to see how you're doing. And so I just don't really like them. But I got so pissed off in 2008. That's really what made me write this, is I said, I got to get this out to people, and I got to get it in a form that's inexpensive and they don't have to go to a seminar to do it. Because the amount of abuse that happens in the financial system, as you guys both know well, it's not a bunch of evil people trying to destroy people's lives. It's just a bunch of very large corporations that are doing what their edict is to do, which is to maximize shareholder value. But that's not to maximize you as an investor. And the only way they can make more money is more fees. And, you know, I've worked with Paul Tudor Jones, one of the top 10, you know, financial investors in the history of the world, literally, for 24 years. I've worked with him literally every day, 5 days a week. He writes me and gives me the details. I meet him 4 times a year in person. And, you know, he's not lost money personally in all those years, which there's nobody in his category of his volume and size that's done that. So I've learned a lot from him. But when 2008 happened, and I grew up with a lot of suffering, so I'm not some great special person. I just hate suffering for others because I know what it feels like. And there was so much suffering, and even in successful, financially successful people, but also it was watching people losing their homes, watching people lose, you know, 50% of their entire, you know, retirement nest egg overnight. And it was so preventable, and it just made me crazy. I did incredibly well during that time because, as you guys know, when things melt down, you can actually do better faster than when they're growing. If you keep your head together, if you know what you're doing, and, you know, I've worked with some of the smartest people on earth in this area. So I just felt like somebody's got to do something. And 2 years later, still nothing was done. And I saw a documentary that won an Academy Award, and it was all about the financial crisis. And it systematically showed how a few people almost destroyed the entire world economy. And then the punishment was we gave them more of our money. It was just like, so at the end of this thing, you're either totally depressed or you're totally angry. I was on the angry side because depressed doesn't change anything. And I thought, okay, I got to convert this energy into something productive. What can I do as one person? I'm not special, but I have a special connection, which is, I know some of the smartest financial people on earth. What if I interviewed 50 of them and I brought to the table the best financial minds on earth? Nobody from the Lucky Sperm Club, everybody who built it from nothing. And so when I got access to Warren Buffett and Jack Bogle and David Swensen and Burt Malkiel and Carl Icahn and all these people, Ray Dalio, the smartest guys in the room. And so then they started referring me, and I got deeper and deeper in that group. So I wrote this 670-page crazy book, as you described, Money Master the Game. And then the reason I hate writing books, but the reason I wrote this book is I thought, we got the longest now, officially, longest bull market in our history. Obviously, a correction is coming. You know, you get a correction every year, but a bear is going to be here at some point. And I want to make sure people are prepared and realize that's the greatest time in their life. I wanted to be able to take a millennial who thinks they have so much debt they can never be out of it and show them in a weekend, and read a book in a weekend and be done, a playbook of here's how to go from where you are to where you really want to be. Or take a baby boomer who thinks, I started too late, I can never get financially secure, and show them how they can do it. And so that was the impetus for Unshakable. And another thing is, you know, I donate 100% of the profits to feed people, because when I was 11, there was no money and no food, and I was fed. So I fed two families at 17, and I got it to 100,000 people, and 1 million a year, 4 million. Now we feed 100 million people a year. For the last 4 years, 400 million people, and I'm going to feed 1 billion over the next 6 years. So 100% of these profits go to help us make that happen as well. So people can change their own life, and we feed 50 families for every book as well.
You know, Tony, my favorite part about your entire response there is right at the end, and it's for multiple reasons, not just the impact, which is somewhat mind-boggling to think that you are going to be able to feed 1 billion people. But I think for the person that's listening to this, kind of wondering about the information they're about to receive, when a person says that they give all the proceeds of the book away to a charity, you are incentivized to tell the truth. You're incentivized to provide the best information you can provide. And that is not how a lot of the finance industry is structured. And I think that is such an important part for people to take away from this, is that you are not incentivized. Buffett has a quote. We heard him at the last shareholders meeting. He said, "You show me the incentive and I can show you the action or the reaction." I'll tell you what, your incentives for this are really in the right place. And let me just throw this out there, and I'm sorry to be talking so much because we want to hear from you, but feedamerica.org/Tony Robbins. If you want to participate in this and help Tony achieve this feeding 1 billion people, go there, and we'll have a link to that in our show notes. So
thank you for that, but I just want to plant a seed, and that is if they just buy the book, I'll feed 50 families. But if they want to join me, we have 49 million people in the richest country in the world that wake up every morning not knowing where their next meal is going to come from. 17 million are children. So that's not a statistic to me, because I was one of those. It's not like I'm some good person. It's just I've suffered enough that I don't want anybody else to suffer. But if you donate $100 or you donate $1 million, up to $4 million I match every year. So there's no limit other than $4 million. So you can put $10 in and I'll match it, and you'll double your impact. Or you can put no money in and just get the book and I'll feed 50 families. But I hope people who care about this issue, not everybody does, but they do, double your impact and join me in this, and I'll match you on whatever you do.
Tony, I really love how you include yourself and your own story in your response there, because it is no secret for those of us who have been following your career that financially you had the deck stacked against you in your early life. Talk to us about how your life were in the early years, and then what has happened since? I know there's been quite a few things has happened since, but your personal journey to where you are today, in your own words, how did this happen?
You know, I always tell people, you overestimate, most of us overestimate what we can do in a year, and then we're disappointed. But we underestimate what we can do in a decade of growth, or in my case, 4 decades of growth, right? So there have been a lot of stages along the way. But I grew up in a family where I had an incredible mother. She loved me completely. I have a younger brother, younger sister, 5 and 7 years younger. So I was kind of the adult in the room. And my mom was a good human being, but a troubled lady. And she abused alcohol and prescription drugs. And she got a little crazy. So she would, you know, smash my head against the wall till I bled. She would pour liquid soap down my throat because she thought I was lying, and I threw up, and I wasn't lying. And so when somebody you love is trying to harm you, and yet you still know they love you, it messes with your head a little bit. But I finally figured out I needed to become a practical psychologist. I need to be able to predict her moods and change them. I need to understand what was driving her. And so much of who I am came, you know, I often say that if my mother had been the woman I'd hoped she was, I wouldn't be the man I'm proud to be. And so I'm truly grateful to her, because she did the best she could do, and she really did love me. But she had huge problems, and I had to learn to separate people's behavior from who they are, because otherwise I'd go crazy. And so that helps me today. When somebody behaves insanely, meanly, harshly, I know that that's not their soul, their spirit, that's their behavior. And so that helped me to be able to help other people. I think along the way, I learned that if I could keep learning, if I could become a learning machine, that any problem I could solve any problem I had, if I could solve it for me, I could solve it for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, eventually tens of millions of people. And so my path has been really just constant growth. I took a speed reading course when I was 17, and I said, you know, leaders are readers. You know, I want to compress decades into days. If I can take 30 years of a guy's life and I can compress it down to the most important insights, I could save a whole lot of time and serve a lot of people, including myself. And so I didn't read a book a day, but in 7 years, I read 700 books in the area of human development, psychology, physiology. And pretty soon, you recognize that everything is a pattern. You know, as financial, your financial orientation, it's all pattern recognition, pattern utilization. You're really smart, pattern creation. That's what makes somebody brilliant in any field, and certainly in finance. And so I got really good at recognizing everything is a pattern with human beings, and that there are patterns that make you angry, patterns that make you sad, patterns that make you grateful, patterns that make you excited. And if you think it's you, it's hard to change you. But if you realize there's this pattern, you can change anything. And once I understood that, my capacity grew. And so by being put on the line with no net for decades, you tend to grow. And if you're passionate about constantly getting better, you expand. And so over those decades, that's happened. And then I began to grow companies because early on, I realized my ideas are going to die on my lips unless I learn to grow and build a company and develop innovation and marketing. And so I had none of those skills, and I was terrible. But I created Raving Fan Clients, which made up for my education in the business side. And now I'm privileged enough to have 54 companies, 12 I actively manage. We do over $6 billion in business in 14 different industries, as unique as stem cells to, I'm one of the owners of the LAFC. I have an esports team. I love to light people up. I love to arm people with strategies and tools that give them control of their own life. And so finance is one of those areas.
So Tony, what I captured at the start of what you were saying is so important that we found. There was a book by Carol Dweck. She's out of Stanford.
Oh, yes, I'm familiar with her. She's great.
Yeah, the book Mindset. And when you were talking about your quote there where you said, if I didn't have the mother that raised me that way, I wouldn't have become the man that I became. It takes a person with a growth mindset to be able to understand that and not really play the victim card, because so many people that are going through a rough upbringing like that are saying, well, I can't succeed because, I'm a victim, or I was treated this way. And I can only imagine how hard it is to teach yourself or train your mind to think, I'm not a victim. This is an asset in some way. How does a person go about doing that? I can't wrap my head around how a person can make that transition without coaching or somebody, some positive influence in their life. So for you at that early age, how did you make that transition of the mindset?
I think it honestly was reading biographies and autobiographies in mass, meaning some of the most brilliant humans in history. And I'm reading their stories, and I went from feeling sorry for myself to going, this is part of the path to growth. This is part of the path to becoming a person who has influence and impact in a beautiful way in the world, because virtually every story I read, Churchill came from a very, privileged background, but the hell that man went through, in order to try and save his country and turn the world around is just extraordinary. And so you read these stories, and all of a sudden I couldn't tell myself the story of the victim anymore. And I think the other reason is because as a victim, I can't help anybody. And I've always had this internal drive of, I just love human beings. I love to see them feel fully alive. I hate to see them in pain. And so if I'm a victim, then my life is over. And most people pick the victim approach, not because then they're victim oriented, but because they're just scared. We're all deathly afraid we're not enough. I've never met anybody, presidents of countries, billionaires. We all have a place where we feel we're not smart enough, rich enough, young enough, old enough, sexy enough. I don't know anything enough. And when you feel like you're not enough, the deeper fear is you won't be loved. And love is the oxygen of life. And so most of us are, especially with social media, are trying to constantly prove that we're somebody special. But, there are people, I have a friend that's got it, one of the top gyms here in South Florida. And he told me, Tony, every single day people come in, men and women, set up all the weights, take a bunch of pictures, and don't work out. And they post it on Facebook and so forth because they just want to project this image. Scary, because the only way you have self-esteem, esteem for yourself, is by making yourself do incredibly difficult things. Things that no one else can know, but you know. Pride comes from pushing through. It doesn't come from ease. The path of least resistance will never make you proud. It'll never make you strong. It'll never make you fulfilled. It'll make you weak. So for me, early on, the approach to being a victim it just meant you couldn't, your life would have no meaning. It means that, yeah, you could point to something and say, that's why my life is this way. It's not me. There's nothing wrong with me. You can still love me. But who wants to live that way? And so I think, you know, I didn't have role models, but I had role models through books. Books allowed me to transport myself to World War II, another time, to another history, to another way of thinking. Plus, if you read an autobiography where the author themselves wrote it, and it's like you think like the author as you do that. And so if you keep reading those things, you get the pattern of thinking of some of the most brilliant minds on the planet. And so my whole thing is, my original teacher was Jim Rohn. He used to say, miss a meal, Tony, but don't miss reading 30 minutes a day. And I don't mean clickbait. I don't mean some blog. I mean like a real book where something that's got strategy or philosophy that can help you change your life or help someone else. And so that obsession for decades has really served me really well. But I think the other thing is, I think I learned early on that life is worthless if it's just about you. It's not about me, it's about we. You know, and this whole me mindset that we have today, like, what am I getting? What am I not getting? You know, what's, you know, who's hurt me, or who, you know, they don't usually ask, who have I hurt? Because everybody's hurt somebody, even if you didn't intend it or been hurt by somebody, but that's life. You know, it's like, step up and grow. But I think the biggest thing is, early on, I realized that life is about adding value. It's not just business. You can't get wealthy, you know, financially without adding value. Even as an investor, you're providing capital to the right places. And if they add enough value, you're going to win. If you can do more for other people in your life, in your relationships, in your business, you're going to prosper. You're going to have beautiful relationships. You're going to have beautiful business. You're going to have a beautiful life. There is no substitute for adding more value than anybody else and constantly improving the way you add that value. And if it's in business, you got to also market that value, because you're going to have the best product. But if you don't get it out to people where they want it, it dies on your lips. And so I think it's a combination of those things that helped to shape me.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Value investing in 2024 is lonely. You listen to the podcast and spend countless hours researching companies, but still feel like something is missing. What it is that you don't have others around you to help accelerate your learning efforts and your portfolio returns. This is exactly why we launched our TIP Mastermind community. In the TIP Mastermind community, we have nearly 100 passionate value investors joining our weekly live Zoom calls, sharing stock ideas, connecting with TIP hosts, joining our calls with special podcast guests like Chris Mayer and Gautam Bade, and most importantly, building lifelong relationships. We also host 2 live events per year in New York City and Omaha to take those relationships one step further. The TIP Mastermind community is exactly what I needed as an investor, so we decided to create it ourselves. Now I'm surrounded by so many like-minded investors who continually help me step up my game. We're capping the group at 150 members, so if you'd like to learn more, you can visit theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. That's theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. When Rainn Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this. A talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Do you guys ever feel overwhelmed with all that's going on in the markets, and you feel like you just can't keep up with the day-to-day news headlines? Today's show sponsor, Yahoo Finance, is my go-to solution to keeping up with today's top news and stay informed with what's happening globally. With Yahoo Finance, I'm able to see the biggest trends and biggest movers in the stock market, what's happening with interest rates, major geopolitical events, and much more. If it wasn't for Yahoo Finance, I would have no idea that Tesla is laying off 10% of their staff, or why iPhone shipments are down 9% year over year. Yahoo Finance also has a number of other cool features, including a tool that lets you link in all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts. Yahoo Finance is one of my favorite tools that I use in my investing toolkit, and it's what I read each morning to kick off my day to stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets. Join more than 90 million monthly users today and get comprehensive financial news and analysis at yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show. So, Tony, we actually invited you here on the Investors Podcast to talk about your new book, Unshakable. And it seems like we're talking about everything aside from that. So sorry about it. And here's another question that's not about the book. With your knowledge, with your extensive set of skills, and with everything that you have experienced, if you had to go back and give a piece of advice and do that to yourself whenever you were 20, 30, 40, and 50, respectively, and here's the kicker, it has to be the same advice. So regardless of where we are in life, and regardless of the age we are, what would it be?
That's a great question. It's an interesting question. I wouldn't necessarily think that at every age it's the same advice, but sometimes repetition is the mother of skill. If I had one piece, is it's add more value. I mean, it's my mantra. It's my obsession. It's like, what? How can I do more for others? And that's not just because I'm a good person or something. I think I am a good human being, but it's really because that's the only thing that's fulfilling. And what makes you fulfilled is growing and giving. If you're not growing, I don't care how many trophies you have. I don't care how many millions of people love you. I don't care how much money you got, or how many, you know, Academy Awards you have, or whatever your way of measuring is, you're not going to be happy. You know, how many people have you seen that are incredibly wealthy, that have honored in every way, millions of people love them, and then they kill themselves, right? Because they stop growing. And then growth gives us the opportunity to give. And I think, look, everybody can be selfish. But when people say human beings are selfish, we can be selfish. I've certainly been selfish. But that's not who we are. And my proof to that would be, look at what people do when they have a great experience, when something transforms you, when something is so joyous. The first thing we want to do, share with somebody we love. Why is that? Because you can only have so much pleasure in the body by yourself, right? From, you know, achievement, acknowledgement, success, money, drugs, alcohol, rock and roll, whatever it is that floats your boat. But there's only so much we can hold inside. But when we grow and we give something, then our life has a different form of meaning. It's not about just being happy every moment. If you're happy every moment, your face hurts. You know, we've all experienced that. But what you want is meaning. Then life is beautiful. So I'm pretty obsessed with trying to bring that to people as much as I possibly can.
I love it, Tony. Such awesome information. Pains me to transition away from such deep thought and like such motivation for people. But, you know, Stig and I just love finance too much to stay off topic.
What's so great about that is I don't care who you are. Finance isn't everything. But when people are struggling financially, they have problems in their relationships.
Yeah.
They struggle financially. They snap at their kids and they feel bad about it. They struggle financially. They beat themselves up internally. When they struggle financially, it helps them physically. So I think this is one of the areas of life, body, emotions, relationships, spirit. But it's one of the areas we got to master. And I'm grateful you guys are doing this. And I'm grateful so many people listen to you, because I know you guys, both minds, hearts, and the way you move and the way you teach is not for your own personal gain. And there's nothing wrong with people gaining from their business. Don't get me wrong. But I know your true incentives, because I've listened to a couple of podcasts and I've read about some things you guys have written. I've talked to people that have interacted in your shows. And they all talk about your absolute sincerity and your desire to serve. So that's why I feel like we're brothers on the path.
I can't tell you how much that means. That just made my month. Tony, so in your book, the first time I read through this, and I'm gonna hold this up to the screen so you can see my yellow highlight here.
And
my dog tagged or my earmarked page for this particular quote, because I loved this quote. And this came from Jack Bogle in your book. And the end of the quote says, you put up 100% of the capital, you took 100% of the risk, and you got 33% of the return. Explain to our audience what Jack's talking about here in your book.
This is, first of all, this is what I was saying earlier about the system. I mean, when I met Jack, one of the first things he said to me is this, after we spent, you know, he invited me for 30 minutes and I was there for 4.5 hours. He said at the end, he gave a quote saying, you know, I invited Tony over for 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And he goes, 4 hours later, I had the most intense interview of my 65-year career, but we became good friends. And one of the things he said to me is, Tony, he said, you really, I think, could educate people. And he said, if you're going to make a difference, you've got to show people the impact of fees. He said, especially in the 401k space, everywhere, but in the 401k space, because that's where 90% of Americans have their money. It's in their home and it's in their 401k space. And the abuse in this system is just insane. So before I answer your question, let me give people a context. Here are these companies. Imagine, let's take 401k, where everybody puts their money. The majority of Americans put their money. It's a $6 trillion industry with a T, trillion. Up until 4 years ago, they didn't have to tell you what they're charging you. What industry on the face of the earth can take your money without telling you what it is and you'd accept it? And as a result of that, 71% of Americans still think their 401k has no fees. There's no bigger lie on the planet. And so four and a half years ago, the Department of Labor changed the rule and said, you have to show people what they're being charged, which is like exciting. But how did the industry respond? They're not going to give up this cash flow. So they come up with 30 to 50 page disclosure documents that if you got a PhD in finance, maybe after 4 hours, you can find all the hidden fees, which are usually about 17 of them. You know, Forbes put out an article that shows the average person in their 401k is paying 3.25%. They'll get Vanguard and they'll charge you 2.5 points hidden inside there. Management fees, they call it. Vanguard, you can get for, 5 basis points, 5/100 of a percent for those that don't understand what I'm talking about. That's like, do you want to buy a Honda Accord for $30,000 or would you rather pay $800,000 for the same car? There are people living next door to each other paying thousands percent more than the person next door for the same product. So you can solve this if you wake up. So here's what Jack was explaining. The average fees, Jack went really conservative. He said, what if the average fees were only 2.5%? He goes, I know they're more. But let's be super conservative. Over an investor's lifetime, that puts 80% of the compounded returns in the hands of the manager, not the investor. And yet most people put their money in a mutual fund. But what happens is 96% of all mutual funds don't match the market. They fail to match the market. So you're paying all these fees for nothing, for underperformance. And it's going to somebody who's not doing anything to your advantage. I mean, here's how it works. And I'll give you the math now. So Jack said, think of it this way. Let's assume that you make a one-time investment of $10,000 at age 20, and it's going to grow in the market at 7%. The market's produced 8% over the last 20 years, but we'll call it 7% to be conservative. He said, by the time you get to the retirement age like me, that's $574,464. But if you pay 2.5% in fees, and most people are paying 3.5, to give you an idea, the total management fees and the other expenses also compound. And so you end up not with 574,000, you end up with 140,000 in the same period. So you put up 100% of the capital, you took 100% of the risk, they got 439,000, you got 140 grand. That's 77% of your returns are going to somebody else who's usually underperforming. It's insane. So this is the big underpinning that, if you talk to somebody like Jack Bogle or David Swensen at Yale, who's the greatest institutional investor of all time, he'll tell you, the greatest ripoff on the planet are these mutual funds. And it's all because there's no way they can beat the market after fees. It just doesn't matter how smart these guys are. And they're not that smart. You look at the hedge fund industry. I mean, it's been decimated in the last 6 or 7 years because it doesn't match the market. And they charge 2% plus 20% of your profits. The biggest scam on the planet. Unless you got a Ray Dalio or a Carl Icahn or, a Warren Buffett. Outside of that, these guys, there's a few players that are unicorns in the whole world. The rest of them do not win over time.
So, Tony, in continuation of that discussion, I would like to talk about your first book, Money Master the Game, back from 2015. One of the key concepts that Preston and I took away from that book was Ray Dalio's all-weather portfolio mix. You talk about how stocks were only one among several asset classes. Now, in Unshakable, the main focus is on stocks, even though that you also briefly mentioned other asset classes and how you can mix that into your portfolio. But regardless, what has changed, if anything, in the markets? And say that you're a real estate investor, then you do not follow the market like on a day-to-day or even a year-by-year basis, but you just want a passive approach. What should you do?
I just interviewed Ray Dalio again yesterday. Ray's a dear friend now. And for people who don't know Ray, I think most of your audience probably does, he's the most... you think about investors, he's one of the most successful investors in the history of the world. He's the most successful hedge fund investor in the history of the world, returned more capital to investors than anyone alive. So pretty brilliant man. And he just wrote a book that your audience would probably enjoy. And if they go to principles.com, he wrote a book called Principles, but he has a new book that is on the market crashes. It's really a template of all the market crashes in the last 100 years. And he shows how he navigated in 2008 and so many other times successfully when everybody else was decimated. So I think if they want to go deeper than my conversation, Ray's a good place to go. The reason I put less of him in Unshakable is just I wanted to go from 760 pages, down to 250 that you could do in a weekend. So I still mention it. But yes, the market is highly valued right now. But here's what I've learned for context that I think is really important. Nobody successfully calls the market over time. Nobody. Warren Buffett is not a market guy. He's a value guy. And he will tell you he's going to be wrong. Every one of the smartest men in the room, they're not the CNBC commentators that tell you they know what they're doing. Every one of them says, Tony, this is what I think, but I know I'm going to be wrong. So So they do four things, and then I want to create context for you. That, you know, Ray Dalio is a, you know, completely different investor than Jack Bogle, than David Swensen, than Burt Malkiel, than Carl Icahn. They all do it differently. But what they all had in common were four things. One, they all are obsessed with not losing money. And they don't do that by trying to time the market. Like, if you talk to Ray right now, yesterday he told me, he said, listen, where we are in the business cycle, he says, I could be wrong, but I don't see a 2008. Here's why. But I do know in the next two, probably maybe 3 years, we're going to have a significant correction because that's the business cycle. And this is one's been extended for a long time. And he gave us all the reasons. But he could be dead wrong. He knows he could be dead wrong. So the way they defend that is what I teach is, you know, the most important financial decision is to become an investor, to become an owner, not just a consumer. But the most important investment decision, bar none, that every one of these men agree with, and women, the way you protect yourself is asset allocation. As Ray said it, you know, everybody has a favorite investment. If you grew up as a kid and your family was constantly rehabbing homes to try to make money, then real estate's your gig because you were reinforced forever. If somebody gave you a stock at 12 and you still own it, you're a stock guy. But I don't care what asset class you have or how smart you are or how well you've done over time. There is a day when that asset class, every asset class, will drop 50 to 70%. And if that's later in your life, you're completely screwed. So we all know we got to diversify, but it's really how much goes it, you know, in risk assets where the upside's unlimited, but the downside's unlimited. What percentage of those assets go in less risky environments that have less return, but through time can still compound? And as you well know, that has to do with when do you need the money? You know, what's your risk tolerance? And, you know, how much access do you have? Cash flow are factors that influence that. But the first thing is most investors are obsessed with trying to make money. These guys, to a man and to a woman, are obsessed with not losing money because they know if I lose 50% in a market, it doesn't take 50% to get even. If you had 100 grand and you ask the average person, you lost 50%, how much do you got to get to back? They'll say 50%. No, if you had 100 grand, it drops to 50. Now you do 50% improvement, you're at 75, you're still 25,000 in the hole. It takes 100% improvement. So these guys know that and they defend it by asset allocation because they know they're going to be wrong. Second, they're all obsessed with this whole concept of how do I get the least amount of risk with the most amount of return, right? And so this mindset, most people think billionaires are people that took gigantic risks and they got lucky or they had balls of steel, intestinal fortitude. That's not how 99% of them do it. They all do this by looking at things and saying, I want to have a risk ratio where I'm asymmetrical. I have asymmetrical risk reward, very little risk with gigantic potential upside if it works. So for example, I've coached for Paul Tudor Jones for 24 years, not lost money in 24 years at what he does. Pretty amazing. How does he do it? Well, part of it is, you know, when I met him, he had some challenges and he left one of the principles. I dug it out that he had lived by and it was 5-to-1. If I'm going to risk a dollar, I want to try and make five. I know I'm going to be wrong a lot of the time, but if I'm wrong, I can risk another dollar. I'm still making a ton of money on five. He can be wrong 4 times out of 5 and still be okay. Whereas the average person is trying to get that 10 or 12%. He knows he's not going to get every time, but he goes for it. I'll give you a better example. Kyle Bass, you guys probably know of, pretty famous because in, you know, the worst economic time in the last, you know, 80 years, you know, in the middle of 2008, 2009, he took $30 million and converted into $2 billion. How did he do it? Well, he bet against real estate. Everybody thought real estate's going to go up forever. He bet against it. But here's the brilliant part. He structured his bets with asymmetrical risk reward, which means he never risked more than 6 cents to make a dollar. You could be wrong 15 times and still make money. That's how you take $30 million and make $2 billion in the worst economic time in history. Or one more example would be Richard Branson. I'm lucky enough to be friends with him, and he's such a genius. But if you look at Richard, this is a guy everybody thinks huge risk taker, and he is with his life. I mean, 4 or 5 months ago, I almost died in a bicycle accident. He's gone balloon accidents, you know, boat accidents. He puts his life on the line, but he never does that investing. His whole thing is, what's the downside? That's where he starts. He doesn't want to lose money. And he's obsessed with asymmetrical risk reward. And so when he was starting Virgin, big risky thing. You're going to take on one of the biggest British airlines and you're going to buy 10 Boeing jets. So what he did was he negotiated for one full year with Boeing until he got them to agree that if he did not make it in business in the first 3 years, he could give all the planes back with no economic loss to himself. So look at this. No downside, 100% upside. Well, that makes your business a lot more comfortable to run than where most people do. Third thing they all agree on is they really want to make sure they're tax efficient because they know it's not the dollars you earn, it's the dollars you keep. So I train all the people that work with me Tell me what it really is after taxes and after all fees. That's all that really matters, the spendable dollars. You know, you guys know compounding. You take a dollar and you double it for 20 times, you know, $1, $2, $4, $8, it becomes $1,028,000. But if you just pay 33% in tax each year, most people you say, well, what would that be? If 33% tax, and I end up with $1,048,000 was the number, what will I end up with? And people go, well, see, 33% tax, well, 33% of, you know, million is 700,000. So you're probably, you know, you're going to still, you'll lose 33,000, you're going to have 700,000. No, with compounding, you compound the cost. So you end up with $28,000 instead of $1,048,000. If you're just paying 33% tax. So these guys don't start with tax. Starting to invest based on taxes is stupid. That's not investing. That's, you're getting involved in a scam. But if you found a good investment, believe you're not going to lose money and you're diversified enough, you've got the right asset allocation, and you've got some asymmetrical risk reward, now you want to keep as much as you can. And so they focus on all the ways to do that. And then finally, the fourth one is really one we all know. It's diversification, but they're obsessed with it. They want to diversify, obviously, amongst assets. They don't fall in that trap of, I love real estate, I love stocks. They have to diversify because they know they're going to be wrong. But they diversify across assets, nothing in just real estate or just some, but they also diversify within assets. I don't have one piece of real estate that I put everything in, obviously. They diversify across countries and they diversify across time because you're going to have some timing that's going to be off. But if you diversify in all those ways, even in the lost decade, remember, you know, where the S&P was basically flat for 10 years, you know, if you diversified across indexes across multiple countries, you know, and if you dollar cost average your investments, as an example, just those two diversifications across time and across location, you made an average of 7% compounded through time, even in the lost decade. So there's always a way to win if you understand these dynamics. And all these people are different, but these four things are in common. Don't lose money, asset allocation. Make sure you look for as much asymmetrical risk reward as possible. Be tax efficient so you keep more dollars and diversify your tail off. Those four things are the things they all had in common.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, this is Clay Fink. Before I became a host on We Study Billionaires, I hosted one of our other podcasts called Millennial Investing. Kyle Grieve and Patrick Donnelly have done an incredible job now hosting that show and taking it to the next level. For example, Kyle recently hosted an amazing episode with Chris Mayer on episode 310 that gave a masterclass on serial acquirers. Serial acquirers are a very interesting business model with very strong multi-bagger potential. This makes them potentially the dream business for stock pickers like us. Kyle also hosted some other amazing episodes packed full of timeless investing wisdom with guests like Lawrence Cunningham, Robert Hagstrom, and Brian Feraldi. Millennial Investing, along with We Study Billionaires, is definitely one you should add to your arsenal of top podcasts. Check it out today by searching for Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and clicking the follow button. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? For me, nothing beats having my next flight free thanks to NerdWallet. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show. And perhaps, Tony, if we can add a fifth point to this list, we could talk about biases. It seems like all of us, even the best investors, since they're human, they are prone to biases, whether it's confirmation bias, overconfidence, recency bias, is really just to mention a few. And you're also a very successful investor in your own right. So I'm curious to hear, based on your own experiences, and of course also the interactions you have with these high-powered super investors, how do you and how do they combat biases? And which type of impact has it had on that portfolio when they have not been successful?
I'm pretty obsessed with not letting these biases affect me. And I've gotten much better at that in the last 7 years since I started on this with this group of people. Because, you know, when you're around a guy like Ray Dalio, you know, who's, you know, he made money in 2008 when everybody's losing everything, right? He's, you know, had a 23% compounded return over 21 years. I mean, and he's, you know, when I went to go interview him, we were interrupted because he had to take a call from the Chinese prime minister, right? He's managing money for China. You know, it's like, this is a pretty wild thing. And so when he says to me, Tony, you know, what kills everybody in business is, you know, confirmation, you know, all the different biases, but confirmation bias. Everybody looks for other ideas, right, to confirm it. And he goes, Tony, it'll kill you. He goes, I am obsessed with finding people who are very smart, not anybody, because anybody will disagree with you. All you gotta do is go on the web. Everybody thinks they're a genius. But somebody super qualified, as much as I am, but diametrically, I should say, opposed to what I'm doing, and wants to argue with me about it. I want to see, he seeks those people out every day of his life. If you know anything about his culture at his company, it's not for the weak at heart. And everybody's job is to destroy somebody else's idea and prove it there, because only the best survive. And so that mindset has helped me immensely. Because, you know, when I was in the beginning, like, my worst investment was when I was like 23 or 22, I think it was 23, and I lived in Marina Del Rey, and I was just starting to grow a little bit, make a little bit of money. And there was a place in Marina Del Rey in LA, is kind of a high-end beach community, a lot of wealthy people there. And there's a little place around the corner called the Barron's Cleaners. And, you know, that was the place where every celebrity went. And so I went there just to be inspired, you know, to leave my cleaning, but see the people coming in and out. And one day this woman drives up in a brand new Rolls Royce convertible, you know, and she's gorgeous and getting all these clothes. And so I, you know, walked up to her and I said, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I said, I can't help but notice you're obviously quite successful. What do you or you and your husband do? And she said, my husband and I, so I was heartbroken. And then she said, we own a penny stock company. And I said, you got any tips? Like, well, the dumbest ass thing you could possibly do. She's making money because they're taking fees like crazy. It's not their investments. And so she gave me a tip and I put all the money I had in it, which was like, I don't know, $4,000, $3,800, something like that. And I lost it all. I went to zero, right? I think my good fortune is that I've had painful experiences early on that were small enough that it made me sensitized. And then I got trained by the best people. So, you know, what could be the mistake I'll make today? I've got some brilliant RIAs that I work with, you know, I'm partners with, and I bounce everything off them. But I also have the privilege, if I'm thinking about an oil investment, you know, I get to call T. Boone, you know, he's the oil oracle. If I'm looking at where is the market going, I can go from anybody from Paul Tudor Jones to Ray Dalio to Carl Icahn. And these are the people that, you know, I'm able to call friends now. So it's hard to mess up. In fact, and I have to say, most of it was from the implementation of the same systemic thinking that made these guys great investors on the business side. I'm a product of the people that I work with. So I'm far from perfect, but so far things are going really well because I'm surrounded by the best people and I don't make decisions on my own or think I'm the smartest guy in the room, because I'm not.
The way you started there and you were talking about confirmation bias and how Ray had kind of suggested that was one of the ones at the top of the list. For me, I felt like I learned a lot about all these biases by studying Robert Cialdini. I'm assuming you're a fan of Robert Cialdini.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Cialdini for 30 years.
Is there anyone else that you've read through the years that you would put at par or that could also complement some of that information that Robert Cialdini puts out?
Well, there's so many books that, you know, like that the nudge type books and so forth that will also give you additional tools. But I don't think there's anybody in his class. I interviewed him, gosh, I think it was 35 years ago for the first time when he first was, you know, at Arizona speaking and, you know, and teaching these principles. I think it was even before Influence was out. And then he came out with Influence. So I don't think there's anybody better. I highly recommend that book to anyone to understand those unconscious tools. But I also think more of his focus is understanding the unconscious tools that trigger you to feel like you're forced to do something, social proof, reciprocation, all those things. I think it's really important for you to study the best investors, and you guys interview them, so you guys are a great source of it. In Money Master Game, you know, I did 10 of those interviews with some of the best in the world, because what you start seeing are patterns that not only what not to do, that's part of it, but also what to do. And I think you need both. You need the guardrail so you don't go off the cliff. You also don't need where to steer. You know, I learned to become a racer when I was in my 20s and, you know, went to racing school, and I'll never forget. I went to Laguna Seca, not far from you guys are. And I got with this driver, who's one of the best in the world, and became a good friend. He goes, I'm going to show you what a car can do. And he sticks me in this car. And, you know, if you go to Laguna Seca, there's this area where you go, it's corkscrew. You go straight at a wall and go around it. And we're going 165 miles an hour straight at a wall. And he showed me what a car could do. At the end, he goes, you know what? You know, in 4 days, you're going to do that too. And I was like, dude, I mean, this is insane. He goes, Tony, we're not going to have you do that corkscrew on your own. I'm going to be beside you. And we're going to put you in a spin car. And it was a great metaphor. He goes, if you're going to be a great driver, I don't care if you're the best driver on earth, there's going to be a situation out of your control. There's going to be somebody whose car breaks up in front of you, or their tire is going to go through, you know, towards your windshield, or there's going to be oil in the track you can't see in a wet environment. He's going to say, so the most important skill in racing is coming out of a spin. And as he's speaking, I'm thinking that's the best metaphor for life, because everyone does well when it's going well. What do you do when you're in a spin, when things aren't working, when you can crash? And he goes, all you got to remember is we're going to be in a car. You're going to drive at 120 miles an hour, and you're going to find out how much concentration that really takes. You know, people think, you know, drivers aren't athletes. They are. You're sweating just from the concentration, and your muscles are flexed. Everything's going. He goes, the minute you lose certainty or lose focus, he goes, everybody does. I got four buttons on the right here, and I'm going to touch one of those buttons, and it'll lift up one of these four wheels, and we're going to spin out of control in that direction. He goes, now, here's what you got to do. He goes, everything in you is going to want to look at the wall, because A, if we hit the wall, minimum, there's going to be damage you're going to have to pay for, and really bad, we die. And he goes, and I'm not in control, you are. So he said, you're going to have to really focus. But here's the key, come out of a spin. Focus on where you want to go. Don't focus on what you're afraid of. And I thought to myself, no problem, right? But then I'm going 125 miles an hour at a wall, and all of a sudden, I lose a little bit of concentration. He pushes that button, we're spinning out of the wall. And what do? I immediately look at the wall. Because wherever you look is where you steer. Now, he's going to save both our lives. So he physically grabs my head and shoves it to the left where we need to turn. Well, I'm fighting him because I want to see the death happen, right? It's like, and so, but because he keeps shoving my head, I steer to the left where my head goes is where you steer. And now you're doing the right thing, but you don't get immediately rewarded. That's the problem in life. You ate like a pig for 30 years. You dieted for 5 days. How can I lose more weight? Well, dude, you haven't done this very long, right? And so you're still heading to the wall, so your gut wants to look at it. But he held my head, and sure enough, the final seconds, you know, I'm thinking it's 2 inches from the wall. It's, you know, like more like 10 feet. And my heart's beating out of me. He goes, did you get it? I go, I got it. I didn't get squat. It took a dozen times for me to learn to just train myself to look away. Now, here's why I tell you the story. Here's my question. If you focus on what you want, are you guaranteed to get it?
No.
No. But if you focus on the wall, are you guaranteed to hit the wall?
Pretty high probability.
Yeah. So what we have to train ourselves to do is focus on what it is we really want as investors, as human beings, and not focus on what we're afraid of. And not because we're guaranteed success, but because we're guaranteed failure if you focus on what you don't want.
Yeah. Tony, what a story. Man, it just gives you such a visual on how you can apply that to so many different things that are going on in your life. So I really appreciated that story.
Of course.
Thank you for your time, sir. Seriously.
Well, thank you, guys. I've really enjoyed our time together.
Thank you for your time. I know your time is extremely valuable, and we just want to give you an opportunity to give a handoff to anything that you want to talk about that's your passion.
Well, my biggest passion is feeding people. So I think if people listening in, we've already mentioned it, if you'll pick up this book for yourself, I think you'll find great value for you. I know you will. But also we'll feed 50 families. And once again, if you care about this personally and you want to donate $10, $100, $1 million, up to $4 million, I'll match it. If you go to feedingamerica.org/, I believe it's Tony Robbins, and we can help feed some people together. I'm also doing an X Prize because I want to feed a billion people sustainably around the world. And so we're bringing some of the smartest minds together and putting together a $15 or $20 million prize. We're still refining it in that area. And then, you know, if you care about other subjects, there's a great group of people that I work with. You know, slavery and human trafficking is with more people enslaved today than any time in human history, a smaller percentage of the population, but more people. And it makes me insane. If it was your daughter, what would you do? So I work with a group called Underground Railroad, which is former FBI, SEAL Team 6, and CIA members that go into different countries and train the police how to capture these guys. I've actually gone on these undercover with them, and it is mind-boggling what can be done. So whether you care about slavery or food or anything, find something that you really care about and make that donation, because I can tell you, I don't know anybody. I interviewed Sir John Templeton about this many times, and he said this to me. He goes, I've never met anybody that's tithed. You doesn't have to be religious, who's taken 10% of their income and given it away over a decade, who hasn't become incredibly abundant financially. And I think that most people, when they hear about donations or things like this or philanthropists, they go, yeah, well, easy for them. Or if you're not willing to give a dime out of a dollar, you're not going to give $100 million out of a billion. I had an experience one day where I was young and I was building my businesses and once again, overestimating what I could do in the year and frustrated. And it was around midnight. I was driving on this place called the 57 Freeway in Pomona, California, in Southern California, not a nice place at the time. And I was so frustrated. I was asking myself, I was driving at midnight, you know, why am I not succeeding? Why is this not happening? And then I pulled over literally on the side of the freeway, and I used to keep physical hard journals. I still have this journal. And I wrote one sentence on a full page. I wrote, the secret to living is giving. And I burst into tears. And I just realized, hey, when I started this business, it was all about serving and helping people. And now I'm frustrated. I'm not succeeding. It's all about me. And I just realized that's why I was so unhappy, and that's why it wasn't going the level I was. I mean, it takes time to build something, you know? And, you know, that started to turn the corner, but about 3 months later, I was still in a tough financial place. I wasn't in a bad psychological place, but I just wasn't resourceful enough yet. And I had, I don't know, 19, 20, 21 bucks. I think it was around $21. It was all in change and small bills, you know? And I couldn't pay my rent. I'm living in this 400-square-foot bachelor apartment in Venice, washing my dishes in the bathtub and eating on this hot plate on top of a trash can. It was terrible. So I went to this place called El Torito because it was a taco bar. You could have tacos and burritos and salad. And I think I'm just going to load up on these carbs. And I left my car at home. I walked 3 miles to it. It's not a big walk, but I didn't want to pay for the parking. It's like you only got 21 bucks or 19 bucks, whatever it was. So I go and I load up. I eat like crazy. And I'm looking out. You know, I went there also because there's these yachts that go by. And that was completely more opposite than my lifestyle. Just reminding me, there are people doing well, even though you're not, buddy. So you're missing it something. And so sure enough, I finished the meal. And right as I'm finishing, this gorgeous woman walks in. I couldn't help but notice she's just really beautiful. But then I'm waiting to see the guy she's with. And the door behind her that's holding the door is a person half her size. And it's this little boy. He's probably 8, 9 years old, third or fourth grade, if I remember right. And he's wearing a suit and tie and a little vest and held the door for his mom and pulled out the chair for her and sat down and gave her total presence. Like you could just see he was not distracted. He was there for his mom. And I don't know, something about it just moved me. And so I was on the verge of tears. I don't even know why. It just triggered something in me. And so I went and paid for my meal, you know, whatever, it was $5.95. So I don't know, you know, maybe I had $16, $17 left, whatever it really was at the time. And so I walked up this little boy and I didn't look at his mom and I just shook his hand and I introduced myself and I said, what's your name? And I think I can't remember now, it's been somebody, I think it was Charlie. And so Charlie, I said, you're a class act. I said, you know, I saw how you held the door open for your lady here and how you held the chair for her and how you're so present with her. And I said, that's amazing. You're here taking her to lunch. And I said, then it's even more impressive. And he goes, well, I'm not taking her lunch because, you know, I don't have a job yet. And I said, yes, you are taking her lunch. And I had no plan to do this. I just reached in my pocket spontaneously, took all the money I had on earth, 14, 15, 16 bucks, whatever, and some change, put it on the table in front of him. And he looked up and his eyes got really big. And he goes, I can't accept that. I said, yes, you can. He goes, how come? I said, because I'm bigger than you are. And then I started to laugh. And he giggled. And I didn't even look at his mom. I didn't do it for that. I walked out of that room, the restaurant, no car. And I kind of skipped home. I probably looked like a total idiot. But I was high as a kite. And, you know, I should have been like, what the F did you just do? You don't have any money for your next meal, right? And that's the way my mind had always been, like scarcity.
Yeah.
And I went home and I had no fear. I can't even explain it to you. I woke up the next morning. I knew I had no money, you know, and I had no meal. And I was like, well, fasting, I can do fasting for a few days. And I wasn't stressed at all. And then this unbelievable gift comes to me. And the mail, snail mail in those days, right? Traditional mail. I get the mail from the mailman around noon. Haven't eaten a thing, not worried about it. And I open up all these bills, which is a little depressing. But then I get this personal note. I undo it and read it. And it's this man I loaned $1,000 to 3 years before who was desperate. I didn't have a lot of money, but I loaned it to him. I chased him for 6 months because I needed the money so bad. He wouldn't even return my phone calls. And he writes me this long letter apologizing, saying, you were there for me when I needed it, and I wasn't there for you, but I am now. And he gave me like $200 of interest. So I had $1,200. In those days, that would have lasted me 3-4 weeks, right? So I'm sitting here reading this letter, crying my eyes out, and just feeling such grace. And it's like, okay, so why did this happen? I don't know why it happened, but here's what I decided. It happened because grace came to me because I did what was right. I didn't do it for a woman's attention. I didn't do it for any reason except it was the right thing to do. I knew in that moment it was the right thing to do. And it was a decision made with no fear. Because, you know, I have a lot of companies now. In the early days, some of these companies were on the verge of bankruptcy during some tough times. I didn't bankrupt any of them, but it was so on the edge. And even in those days, I never went back to this scarcity. I had challenges, but I never had the fear. And so I planted my seeds when I had nothing, and it gave me abundance. And so your listeners, they have something. To teach your brain there's more than enough, and put a systemic way of giving back to something you care about. I don't give it $5 or $10, because I talk about this in the book. Nothing gives you more joy. Nothing changes your biochemistry, because we can measure what happens to you hormonally in your mouth literally minute by minute these days, than giving. You know, if you buy something for yourself, nothing wrong with that, but things don't hold very happiness very long. If you buy experiences, you know, learning experiences, travel, thinking with your family, those have a longer resonance of joy. But all the research shows, it's not just my philosophy, that we are made to give, because when we give, even if you bought coffee for 4 people in line you don't know, the joy in that person's body will be there for a minimum of 24 hours, usually multiple days. You buy something, there's a hit. Maybe when you get in it, there's another hit. But after some short period of time, it doesn't give you the same hit. Plus, it's just not meaningful. So my hope is that the people listening will say, I want to do well, and I want to do good. And I don't have to wait till I do well to do good. I can do good now, and that'll help me do well, because it'll shift my own psychology. It'll make things richer and more. So I hope people are inspired by this conversation. I know most of your audience probably already is huge givers, but why not do a bit more? Do a bit more just to remind yourself what you're capable of. And I know you cannot give like this and not receive on a massive scale. You cannot not prosper if your life is about adding value to other people's lives. And I hope the people here will take advantage at least of the book for themselves and maybe be inspired by that so they can change their own life. If they don't do anything else, I'm still going to feed 50 families for their effort in reading the book.
Thank you, Tony. This was just amazing. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, guys. I really enjoyed it. And listen, if you want to come to an event sometime as my guest, I'd love to have you. So I'm doing an event in New York in November. If you guys want to come as my guest, we'll have 14,000 people there, and it'll knock your socks off. Just let our team know.
Oh, my Lord.
Look on my website. Anytime you want to come, reach out to me, and I'll have you guys. Love to meet you in person.
If there's anything we can do to help you, Tony, seriously, if there's anything we can do with the marketing of, you know, the movie that you're working on, anything, please let us know. We want to help you in any way we can.
You guys are really kind. I will become good friends. I'll look forward to meeting you personally sometime soon.
All right, guys. That was all that Preston and I had for this week's episode of The Investors Podcast. We see each other again next week.
Thanks for listening to TIP. To access the show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. To get your questions played on the show, go to asktheinvestors.com and win a free subscription to any of our courses on TIP Academy. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making investment decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the TIP Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting. TIP.